Take your business further with the smart and flexible American Express Business Gold Card. It offers flexible spending capacity that adapts to your business. You can also earn up to $395 in annual statement credits on eligible purchases at select business merchants. That's the powerful backing of American Express. Terms apply. Learn more at americanexpress.com/businessgoldcard.
Is realizing the full value of your network just a dream? Intel is bringing AI everywhere, building solutions to help modernize and monetize 5G infrastructure, making it possible for telecommunications providers to expand services and drive efficiency by reducing costs and saving energy. The next wave of networks starts with Intel. Learn more at intel.com/starts.
This is Bloomberg Intelligence with Alex Steele and Paul Sweeney on Bloomberg Radio.
Hey everyone, I'm Alex Steele. Paul Sweeney is off this week. So over the next hour, we're going to dig inside the big business stories impacting Wall Street and the global markets. Each and every week, we're going to provide you in-depth research and data on some of the 2,000 companies and 130 industries our analysts cover worldwide. Today, we're going to take a look at how consumers are resisting an almost 10% price gain in the packaged goods sector, plus the moment for lithium M&A has arrived. But first, Vodafone could deliver a faster-than-expected turnaround in Europe, so BI suggests there is scope for at least 5% upside to consensus fiscal 2024 operating free cash flow. The markets this week, I don't know if they agree with that. Let's get details with Bloomberg Intelligence telecom analyst Erhan Gürses. Erhan, before we get to it, it was a really tough week for Vodafone. New CEO cutting 11,000 jobs, saying there's no quick fix. Set the stage for Vodafone first, and then we'll get to the free cash flow outlook.
So you're right. Vodafone gave quite a subdued guidance. So EBITDA is 1% below consensus. Free cash flow is about 8% lower than consensus for the coming year. And the reason for that is basically you obviously have the typical energy cost and inflationary cost pressures, but also the operational performance is really not improving much in key European markets where Vodafone is struggling. These are Germany, Italy, and Spain, particularly in Germany. They tried to increase the prices, but that resulted in quite a significant level of churn. And as a result, we saw organic service revenue growth worsening in 4Q, fiscal 4Q. So that's really not so encouraging backdrop and partly explains the rather bleak picture. But the company is quite keen on executing the strategic initiatives. So it will be interesting to see whether we will be seeing a different picture emerging in the coming quarters.
So, to that point then, maybe this is the worst it gets. Maybe this is like all the bad news is out in the bath and all of that. So if that's the case, what's Vodafone targets for next year? And then walk me through your upside scenario.
So I do think next year, so the fiscal 2024 will be the low point for Vodafone from a profit and free cash flow standpoint. And thereafter, there should be a growth that is looking like sustainable in the midterm. As we mentioned, they gave a subdued guidance that is below consensus. Moreover, there is also a bit of a headwind, an additional headwind in Germany coming from the change in the contract concerning TV, cable TV. So that will be an extra headwind. But as I said, they are cutting workforce quite significantly, which amounts to 10% of their total. They will be seeing an unwinding of the energy cost pressure in 2025, in 2026. So that really sets up the ground for a better performance and also underpins our expectation for improving cash flow outlook.
All right, really fun conversation. Erhan Gürses, thank you so much. Bloomberg Intelligence telecom analyst. From phones to food, because why not? Packaged food producers are feeling the pressure as consumers are finally pushing back against a nearly 10% increase. For more, we're joined by Bloomberg Intelligence senior consumer staples analyst Jen Bartashis. Are we really paying 10% more for packaged foods?
We really are. Oh, and that's 10% more since 6 months ago.
Whoa.
The amount of food inflation that has slowly built up in the system is really astounding. And consumers have really reached the point where they're just saying, you know what, we're buying only what we really need, and they're starting to trade into cheaper products.
Interesting. So if I'm a packaged food company, that's when I know I reach my peak pricing, is when I see those consumers not buying certain things or going to trade down or store-made brands, et cetera?
Exactly. Up until now, the packaged food companies have been pretty successful in passing through price increases. They've been able to offset some of their higher costs. Mm-hmm. But in the grocery store, consumers are looking at it and getting increasingly tired of higher prices. And so when that trade down happens, what we're seeing is that the volumes sold are falling.
Mm-hmm.
And so for these packaged food companies, right now, everything looks good from a top line perspective because inflation has helped bolster prices and the top line is growing. But the volume of what they're selling is shrinking. And at some point, that's going to catch up with them.
So do they protect their revenue or do they protect their margins?
Well, right now, they're trying to not let the margins slide too much.
Mm-hmm.
But that is going to be one of the main focuses that we're looking at through the end of this year, is really how much margin are they going to have to sacrifice to promote volume. Because at some point, the way we see it, they're going to have to either cut prices or they're going to have to, and they can cut prices by running promotions. They
mm-hmm.
can, it's not necessarily an immediate markdown, or they have to bring innovation to the market that justifies the mm-hmm. price that people are paying. And neither one of those is a cheap option.
Right.
And so that's where the margin squeeze comes into play.
What about packaging less food and what they're selling at the same price?
That happens. And that's happened a lot.
Are we going to get like 3 chips in a bag soon or what?
More like 3 Oreos package. But that is one form of price increase that's just due to packaging.
Mm-hmm.
And so one of the things that's happened a lot, and now it's at the point where consumers are noticing that.
Mm-hmm.
When something went from 15 ounces to 14 ounces, people don't notice as much, but when it goes from 15 ounces to 12 ounces,
mm-hmm. that's a big thing.
That's a bigger deal.
So which companies are best positioned to maintain their margins?
Well, right now, when we look at what we call price elasticity, and all that means is how willing are people to pay for that branded item? Are they very willing to pay, or are they less willing to pay? So right now, when we look at that, companies like Hormel
mm-hmm.
have the highest price elasticity. That means people are less willing to pay the price for that. And companies on the lower end of that are companies like Kraft Heinz and Campbell Soup,
mm-hmm.
where people are still willing to pay for that brand. But it's been creeping up across the entire industry, that willingness to pay.
Mm-hmm.
And we've seen private label sales really escalate
mm-hmm.
as people abandon some brands and start trading down into cheaper options.
So who's it good for?
it's not really good for anybody at this point.
But
because,
if you're a store brand? Like
well,
if you're a store that's selling more, I don't know.
Yeah, if you're a store brand, obviously you're pulling people in. But store brands have really focused on building multiple tiers. So
mm-hmm.
they have like a premium tier, a middle tier, and kind of an entry level. And if people are trading down, they're not trading down into like the premium tier. They're trading down into the lower tiers of the
mm-hmm.
private label. So even though they pick up the business, it's not necessarily as big of a win as it could be otherwise for the retailers.
Whereas they kind of want to get them in on the ground floor and then work their way up or come in on the high end.
Exactly.
Interesting.
Exactly.
So does it matter certain packaging companies that have more exposure to different regions in the U.S.?
So it's not so much regions, but it's product types. If you think about where you're willing to buy private label, there are certain types of foods where people inherently buy store brands more often, like shredded cheese. Not a lot of people buy the Kraft brand or the Sargento brand. They tend to buy their local supermarket brand or things like nuts. And Hormel just bought Planters, which really increased their potential exposure to private label
mm-hmm.
sales with that acquisition. And so less about which regions in the country, some are doing a little better than others, but more about where is the bigger threat and where is it easier for consumers to swap down in their daily lives
mm-hmm.
and have it not feel like it's too much of an imposition.
Right. Like I'll take generic peanuts, but I won't take generic Q-tips.
Correct.
For example,
exactly.
I appreciate that's not a packaged food brand, but you know what I'm saying.
Exactly.
So what's priced in stocks of this?
So right now, I mean, what we think that right now what's priced in, you know, is the idea that the top line is going to continue to grow, but a little bit. We think that there's still not that the stocks still aren't fully encompassing the margin risk mm-hmm. in the second half of the year that's going to come from, especially if we have a much weaker consumer than we do now.
What kind of other innovation can they do, or marketing can they do? And I appreciate that both those things are going to cost money. But what's like another lever that they can pull maybe a few years out?
Yeah, so when it comes to innovation, there are really two types of innovation. Mm-hmm. One is the type of innovation that makes the social media splash, right? It generates impressions, it gets the brand out, and gets people talking about it. But it's not a product
not like
that's meant to be sustainable.
Thing, but like something right. else.
Exactly, okay. Not like Bud Light. But like a couple years ago, Kraft Heinz did pink macaroni and cheese for Valentine's Day. Mm-hmm. It's not sustainable. It sounds like it looked like unpalatable.
But it was a thing.
But it got millions of views, right?
Wow.
But then there's long-term innovation where it's really about meeting a consumer need. And so companies that can balance those two types of innovation so that they have people aware of their brands, mm. but they're offering things that actually meet a consumer need are the ones who are really going to do well in the long term with the innovation.
Jen, so great. Always love chatting with Jen. Jen Bartashis, Bloomberg Intelligence Senior Consumer Staples Analyst. Coming up on the program, is the lack of a rate cut as good as a hike?
Take your business further with the smart and flexible American Express Business Gold Card. It offers flexible spending capacity that adapts to your business. You can also earn up to $395 in annual statement credits on eligible purchases at select business merchants. That's the powerful backing of American Express. Terms apply. Learn more at americanexpress.com/businessgoldcard.
Hi, I'm Ron Kraszewski, Chairman and CEO of Stifel. Financial advisors, if you're not growing your practice, you're losing market share. Stifel is a growing, entrepreneurial, advisor-centric firm built for successful advisors like you. Imagine having the resources of the largest wirehouses and the support of the boutique shops, but none of the bureaucracy to get in the way of you serving your clients. At Stifel, it's your business, your book, your clients. I always tell the advisors we're recruiting, I want you to come to Stifel and double or triple your business. Most of them laugh and shake their heads, but I'm serious. Don't take it from me. Take it from Stifel's number one finish in J.D. Power's 2023 U.S. Financial Advisor Satisfaction Study. So there's a reason why 148 financial advisors joined Stifel last year. Come join us and find out why Stifel is the firm where success meets success. Visit www.choosestifel.com.
Stifel Nicolaus and Company Incorporated, member SIPC and NYSE.
You're listening to the Bloomberg Intelligence Podcast. Catch us Saturdays at noon Eastern on Bloomberg.com, the iHeartRadio app, and the Bloomberg Business app, or listen on demand wherever you get your podcasts.
So our question is, a lack of a rate cut as good as a hike? Well, let's ask a man that really feels like we're putting off cuts until next year. Ira Jersey, Bloomberg Intelligence Chief U.S. Interest Rate Strategist, joins us now. Ira, if we don't get the three cuts that the market's still pricing in this year, did we really get a hike?
Well, it is almost like a hike. So the Federal Reserve, if they really want to fight inflation, and you still see inflation going down a little bit, or coming down a little bit, but not very quickly. Mm-hmm. And so the Federal Reserve still has this mandate and wants to focus on inflation. So I think the easiest way for the Fed to kind of not hike too much is to jawbone its way to taking out some of the cuts that are currently priced for not only later this year, but the beginning of 2024. And they've done a pretty poor job doing that, and the market doesn't believe that the Fed is going to go through with its commitment that Jay Powell has made during his post-meeting press conferences, and also is embedded into the dot plot that comes out with the summary of economic projections.
So do you think it's about getting rid of the cuts altogether, or just pushing them out and sort of front-loading them or back-loading them to 2024?
Well, really, in a perfect world, they wouldn't want to cut at all, but the economy is cyclical, so it's hard to believe that they won't ever have to cut again. So basically, it's a matter of pushing out the timing of when the Federal Reserve will cut. And the way that Jay Powell and other members of the Fed might be able to do that is to basically tell the market what are the necessary conditions that we will be cutting interest rates. Now, you know, he can come out and say, well, if there is an exogenous event, you know, something that, you know, we just can't foresee, then certainly we would react appropriately. But it, given a steady state environment, we want to see two things in order for before we start cutting interest rates. One is significantly lower inflation. We want to see core PCE trending toward our 2% target and being pretty close to it. And number two, unemployment rate rising, because remember, those are the two main parts of their mandate and why they adjust monetary policy. And if you think that we're at or near full employment right now, and you think that that inflation is too high, then clearly those are the circumstances under which that they would cut interest rates. So I don't think it's going outside of anything
crazy,
unusual for the Federal Reserve to communicate that. But I think that they should, because I do think that it would actually help them in their monetary policy, because financial conditions have eased quite a lot, primarily because the market thinks they're going to cut later this year.
Haven't they done this? Like, haven't Fed officials said, like, if inflation stays sticky and employment labor market stays too hot, we're going to keep hiking or keep up net optionality?
Well, they haven't said it as explicitly as you just said it. That's how some of us, you know, listen to them and certainly read them, and that's what I think that will happen. But the market doesn't believe them, and we have to keep in mind that the market, in part, is also pricing for kind of an exogenous event or some kind of credit shock, maybe stemming from additional issues with the banking sector that we've seen over the past couple of months. So the market, when you look at the options market and what the option market is pricing, we're actually pricing more or less for the Federal Reserve to do nothing this year, or actually cut way more than two times, so more like five or six times. So you wind up with this bifurcated environment where the market is, where kind of the median expectation is for the Fed to cut three times, but it's really, you know, the Fed to do nothing or the Fed to cut a lot because there's some kind of crisis. So it's almost the market hedging itself almost too perfectly and too well. And that's one reason why I think that that Jay Powell and the Fed kind of need to, you know, maybe tweak their communication a little bit here to be able to take some of those prices out of the market. Now, for the Treasury market, I think that there's two big things that implies. Number one is that two-year yields are a little bit too low.
Yeah.
So our model suggests that they should be about, you know, maybe around 4.25%. And then number two, it's that, you know, when will they start to cut, and when they do cut, will they cut more than, you know, 25 basis point increments? And the answer is probably yes, just later in 2024.
So for that point, if they did come out and said, hey, inflation has to be this and the unemployment rate has to be this for us to cut, what would the this be?
So for inflation, I would say that they could say something like, if, you know, we need PCE inflation, year-over-year inflation to be under 3% and trending toward our 2% target, and for the labor market to deteriorate significantly, meaning that the unemployment rate would go up at least a couple of percent, right? Something like that. You know, a little vague, right? It's not going to be, oh, the unemployment rate needs to go up 1.8%. But they can leave it vague enough that it gives them flexibility. And, of course, by saying this, it's not exactly a promise, but at the same time, it gives the market, I think, a little bit more understanding about what the Federal Reserve's intentions are going forward.
So you mentioned the two-year would be at like 4.25 if we kind of get that. What happens to the rest of the curve? Like, where's the biggest misprice there?
Yeah, well, I think it is the two-year yield. I do think that the rest of the curve would probably sell off a little bit, and you'd see slightly higher yields. But mostly you'd probably get a little bit of a flatter yield curve, or more inversion of the yield curve. So the two-year, 10-year might get back to negative 65, negative 70 basis points, something like that over the next few months. But importantly, you know, that probably wouldn't persist. Because even if Jay Powell and the rest of the Fed is able to manage that kind of no cut or no additional hike tightening of financial conditions that would occur if they were able to jawbone their way out of this, these cuts that are being priced, then the market eventually would probably price in even more cuts than are currently priced, but just further out in 2024 and 2025. So that means later this year you'd start to see a very significant reversal in trend in the inversion, and you'd see a pretty massive uninversion of the yield curve, I think, by year end.
So this is sort of the same question, but I'm going to ask it anyway. If they don't do anything, they don't say anything, they don't price out those cuts in the market, they just hike to 5 and just stay there and do nothing for a while, does it have the same effect then of like massive cuts being priced in then for next year?
Well, I think that the path winds up being significantly different. So you end up in a situation where we get to, say, September, and then we price out the November cut, for example. And and as that occurs and we get closer and closer because of this, you know, time effect, what ultimately happens is that you wind up seeing the front end of the curve just keeps on, it stays kind of where it is, which isn't necessarily the worst thing in the world. But then what happens is the back end of the yield curve probably rallies a lot more, and that, again, makes financial conditions easier than the Fed would want on a term basis. Because, it, you know, if you think about it right now, if you're a corporation, even with credit spreads where they are, you're still borrowing money at 5% instead of, say, 6%, right? And that's not a not a situation that is necessarily you know, that's sustainable potentially for a long period of time, and that means that if financial conditions aren't as tight as they need to be in order to quell inflation, that the Fed then may have to do more later, right? So if they don't take out these cuts that are being priced right now, there's the real chance that the Federal Reserve, by the end of the year, after pausing for a couple of meetings, might actually have to hike again in order to tighten financial conditions. And that's when I get really concerned about how deep the next downturn in the economy can be, is because if the Fed, say, hikes another 100 basis points and hikes to 6%, say, on the Fed funds rate, that might be more than the economy can really handle for the long period of time. And that's when you get more issues in the banking sector and other financial conditions would tighten even further than they would really want. So it's a tough balancing act right now for the Fed. I don't really envy their position, quite frankly.
Really appreciate it. Always wonderful to talk to you. Ira Jersey, Bloomberg Intelligence Chief U.S. Interest Rate Strategist. All right, coming up on the program, the moment for lithium M&A has finally arrived.
You're listening to the Bloomberg Intelligence Podcast. Catch the program Saturdays at noon Eastern on Bloomberg Radio, the TuneIn app, Bloomberg.com, and the Bloomberg Business app. You can also listen live on Amazon Alexa from our flagship New York station. Just say, Alexa, play Bloomberg 1130.
So the proposed merger of Livent and Allkem, which would create a $10.6 billion entity, potentially creating the third largest lithium maker in the world by 2027. Does this mean the M&A moment has arrived? And what does it mean about where we are in the cycle? Well, for more, we're joined now by BI Chemical analyst Sean Gilmartin. Sean, why now? So we actually had the current CEO of Livent on TV, and he was like, oh, we've been in talks for a while, et cetera. But how much of this was really driven by the IRA here in the U.S.?
Yes, thank you so much for having me on, and very, very good question. I saw that interview last week. So listen, I think that's a crucial aspect to this, right? I think as we think through the broader industry, all the folks that are in play are going to be thinking through their supply chains, where they're getting their resources from, and how that ties into ultimately providing battery grade material into EVs here in the U.S.
So taking advantage of like the tax subsidy that you get if I buy an EV, but it has to be made in either certain countries or in the U.S.
Yeah, that's absolutely correct. And to be fair, I think a lot of that stuff is still being worked out. If you talk to these companies directly, they'll tell you they're still kind of ironing through all the details. But from what we know at this point in time, they're going to be wanting material from Australia. They're going to be wanting to upgrade material here in the U.S. or North America to make that compliant and get all the benefits possible.
So is this a good deal?
We think so, yes.
Okay.
It makes a lot of sense just from a portfolio lineup perspective. As you mentioned, you know, I think it essentially gives them critical scale at a very important moment in time. Livent was a very, very good story, in our opinion, prior to this. But as the landscape shifts here over the next 5 years, this puts them right in the conversation with the giants in the room, the Albemarles, the SQMs. They have the technology, they have the know-how, now they'll have the scale to give customers more flexibility and provide the volumes for this growing industry.
So, nerd alert, everybody. I'm going to ask about what kind of lithium deposits this will leave Livent. So there's two ways you get lithium. You can mine it or you can get it from brine. What does this leave Livent with? Like, what kind of deposits do they have? What does that mean for their cost basis and their production capabilities?
Yeah, absolutely. So So before this, taking a step back, they essentially had one asset. It was in Argentina. It was brine.
Mm-hmm.
And so what this does is it gives them not only more brine assets, but it also gives them a hard rock asset in Australia, as well as in Canada, which they were also bringing online kind of mid-decade as well. So there's certainly some overlap. They're now diversified across, like you mentioned, the two key processes, hard rock and brine.
Mm-hmm.
And listen, they were already kind of on the lower end of the cost curve here. I don't think that changes. They kind of understand they've been doing this for a while. So taking the raw materials all the way through to the battery grade final products, they're going to be one of the lower cost producers in the space.
What about technology? Did Allkem have specific technology that would help make mining lithium more effective or efficient?
Listen, I think ultimately Livent, had no experience on the hard rock side, right? So now they'll have that knowledge share on the hard rock mining piece of it. Livent uses kind of a DLE, direct lithium extraction technology, kind of for their brines. And Allkem uses a more of a conventional process, so there'll be knowledge share there. And certainly part of this is, there does seem to be some reasonable low-hanging fruit in terms of synergies.
Mm-hmm.
So I would expect as the talks progress, I'm assuming this deal gets done, which is expected to close kind of back half of this year, they're going to sit down and run through all of that and make sure that they're allocating the capital properly across these projects.
Do we have enough lithium?
Great question. So ultimately, you could get, you ask very smart people, you get responses. There's tons of lithium in the world. Supply is not an issue. The issue is right now the economics behind it, right?
Okay.
So in the 5 to 10 year window that we tend to look at, the issue is, it's going to be still in relatively short supply. Our models currently show a little bit of a surplus kind of the middle of this decade as Australia ramps, but we're back into deficit by the end of this decade, just in our base case scenario. So listen, it's going to be, as it has been, an interesting ride here over the next 5 to 10 years. I think there's a real need for supply to come online still in a major way.
Mm-hmm.
And it's exciting because if you look across, and I know you love materials,
mm-hmm.
there's nothing quite like lithium right now where you can make a reasonable case for 20% plus CAGRs out over the next 10 years. And if you want to be conservative, you can even shave that, 15 to 20%, that's still solid versus GDP type businesses.
Yeah, see, you guys, metals and mining are so cool. All right, Sean, thanks a lot. Bloomberg Intelligence chemical analyst is Sean Gilmartin.
Take your business further with the smart and flexible American Express Business Gold Card. You can earn 4 times points on your top 2 eligible spending categories every month, like transit, U.S. restaurants, and gas stations. That's the powerful backing of American Express. 4 times points on up to $150,000 in purchases per year. Terms apply. Learn more at americanexpress.com/businessgoldcard.
Success is more than the final destination. It's a path you take one step at a time. It's discipline. It's teamwork. And it's the drive and passion inside of us that comes before all recognition. It's what Stifel's been doing for over 130 years. Quietly, yet strategically, Stifel's become one of the fastest-growing wealth management and investment banking firms in the country. Our financial advisors go beyond traditional wealth management to provide clients with direct access to one of the industry's largest equity research franchises and a leading middle-market investment bank. Because success is the drive it takes to keep climbing, the passion to keep investing, the best of each of us made better by the best in all of us. And that is where success meets success. Start your journey at Stifel.com. That's STIFEL.com.
Stifel Nicholas and Company Incorporated, member SIPC and NYSE.
You're listening to the Bloomberg Intelligence Podcast. Catch us Saturdays at noon Eastern on Bloomberg.com, the iHeartRadio app, and the Bloomberg Business app. Or listen on demand wherever you get your podcasts.
We turn now from electric vehicles and lithium within them to used trucks, because in addition to weak demand and rate pressures, truckload carriers are dealing with some lower gains from equipment sales. For more, we're joined now by Bloomberg Intelligence Senior Industrials Analyst Chris Ciolino. Chris, walk us through the landscape, first of all. What's it like out there? We're still kind of muddling along here. No recession yet. What's it like for the truckers?
Yeah, we continue to see used truck values deteriorate here in 2023, which suggests to us that we're approaching a downturn in the heavy truck market and that there's risk to new equipment build rates, particularly as we enter 2024. The used heavy truck auction values actually fell 37% in April, which is the biggest decline that we've seen in our 16 years of data that we get from Sandhills Global.
But why? Is that I'm not buying stuff? Is that what that's about?
Well, we're coming off of kind of an unprecedented increase over the past 2 years because of all the supply chain issues. There was just no equipment available out there. Factories weren't able to produce the new equipment to meet demand. So we saw everyone turn to the used market, which drove up prices. So really, inventories were at, you know, record low levels. Mm-hmm. We're starting to see that normalize a bit, but now kind of these magnitude of declines look somewhat excessive. But we still continue to see some deterioration in the market. Mm-hmm. And the used market's an important, good leading indicator for new equipment purchases, because when you buy a new truck, typically you trade in an old one. And these falling prices may deter truckers from buying new equipment as those trade differentials increase.
I see. When do you think we see the bottom in the trucking market then? Like, is this just the beginning of the end?
I think this is the beginning, because if you look at new equipment, demand still remains remarkably strong. Order books are filled for the year. The backlog's still at a healthy level. Pricing continues to be strong. It's really now some of these early leading indicators that we watch mm-hmm. that are really starting to deteriorate and really deteriorate at a faster pace than what we had seen. So we think the build schedule is pretty set for the balance of the year. But I think as we look to 2024, we're going to be coming off of 3 years of strong growth, that the risk is really more to the downside as we enter next year.
Typically, what do these cycles look like? And I appreciate that we may be anything but atypical, or I guess typical. So normally, what do we see? And then what could this one look like?
Yeah, so there's really two things that drive the trucking market. One, ultimately, you buy a truck to move freight. So this is very much a GDP, industrial economy type growth story. But you also get to a point where it becomes uneconomical to repair your existing fleet. So there's a very defined replacement cycle. Typically, as we look in like a 4 to 6 year window, once you get beyond that, it economically makes more sense to replace the equipment. The third angle here is that emissions rules and regulations also have significant impacts on demand. The last emission cycle or large emissions change that we saw in the U.S. was back in 2006, and you saw a big pre-buy before those regulations went into effect. We have new emissions regulations coming in 2027, so we would anticipate that we'll see a pre-buy probably in 2026. So we think as we go into 2024, it'll be a little bit more of a pause and a down year with maybe some stabilization in 2025 before that pre-buy really starts to kick in.
What companies are we talking about when we come to trucks? And like, what's actually then priced in if we're going to look at the scenario that you've kind of unfolded for us?
Yeah, so if you think about the heavy-duty truck market, like the large trucks that you see on the highway, mm-hmm, it's a mm-hmm. very, very consolidated market. There's four players that comprise 95% plus of the market, with Daimler Truck being the market leader. You have PACCAR, which has the Peterbilt and Kenworth brands here in the U.S., and then you have Volvo and Navistar. Now, Navistar was acquired by Traton, a European company, but those four companies comprise the majority of the heavy truck fleets out there.
So can we switch the conversation for a sec? So like, if things actually go okay, like for example, we've been underestimating the consumer like for 6 months now, and I appreciate this is more industrial and manufacturing, but if things don't play out badly, how quickly can this industry jump back?
Very quickly. Oh. This is a very short cycle business. Build rates and orders could be quite volatile. The market both on the upside and downside can turn quickly. And you know, we have a pretty healthy backlog now, but should, you know, we tip into a
a more of a protracted downturn, mm-hmm. that could evaporate quickly and cancellations will spike. And conversely, on the upside, if things hold up maybe better than expected, you could see production rates hold better than what's anticipated right now, which is, you know, north of a 20% decline for next year.
When do you think we see the bottom in the trucking market then? Like, is this just the beginning of the end?
I think this is the beginning, because you look at new equipment, demand still remains remarkably strong. Order books are filled for the year. The backlog still at a healthy level. Pricing continues to be strong. It's really now some of these early leading indicators that we watch mm-hmm. that are really starting to deteriorate and really deteriorate at a faster pace than what we had seen. So we think the build schedule is pretty set for the balance of the year. But I think as we look to 2024, we're going to be coming off of 3 years of strong growth. That the risk is really more to the downside as we enter next year.
All right. Thanks, Chris. Bloomberg Intelligence analyst Chris Giolino. That is this week's edition of Bloomberg Intelligence on Bloomberg Radio, providing in-depth research and data on 2,000 companies in 130 industries. Remember, you can access Bloomberg Intelligence through BI Go on the terminal. I'm Alex Steele.
Do you love Elon Musk? Do you hate Elon Musk? Do you have no idea what to think about Elon Musk? Then we have just the show for you.
He's become even more larger than life.
Buying Twitter doesn't get us closer to Mars.
They are like really close to the edge of like everything falling apart.
Like, oh, Elon, I volunteer, put a chip in my brain.
Each week on this podcast, we'll break down, analyze, and debate the most important stories on Musk and his empire.
It's all one big universe. You just work for Elon Inc.
From Bloomberg Businessweek, this is Elon Inc. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.